Chapter 1. Offshore, Cutler, Maine, mid-April, 1862. The day began with clear blue skies and warmth that encouraged a lovely drowsiness. For catching cod, George Young Bradley baited his line with squid, which he had jigged for yesterday. He lowered the bait about 100 feet, so it would be just off the bottom. This was where the cod lived. They were easy to catch, because they bit on most everything, and once the hook was set by quickly jerking the line, the cod gave little resistance. He had been hand-lining since daybreak in one of his favorite spots, an 8 to 10 mile row back to home base, which would probably take 2 hours of rowing. George had about a half load of cod when he realized the direction from which the wind was coming had changed, and the pressure was dropping. He was usually a remarkable accurate reader of the weather, but this was a surprise. Wind from the northwest began to pick up, a dark curtain spreading toward him. Change was rapid. At first, the storm only mildly concerned George. April often couldn't make up its mind whether it was winter or spring. This was quickly becoming a winter storm with no warning, or he had missed it. Thunder cracked, wind picked up, seas began to roughen. He rowed harder, while progress toward home was getting slower. Waves started splashing over the gunwales. He threw out some cod to lighten the load. The harder the wind blew, the harder he rowed, the slower his progress. He quickly threw out the rest of the cod and returned to his rowing. It usually took 2 hours of rowing from his fishing spots back to the docks. After he had been rowing for 3 hours through sheets of rain, the strength of the storm increased to almost cancel his forward progress. Trying to block out the pain and weariness of his arms, he needed to change directions if he were to survive. He aimed straight for the coast, about 3/4 of a mile away, with the wind about 15 or 20 degrees to his left. If he could just get outside the surf zone, the sea cliffs would provide some protection from the wind. "I don't want to go the way my father did." This was a thought never far from his mind when he was alone in his boat. Straining at the oars, he fought to break through the surf in search of a landing spot along the rocky coast. The storm darkened the day. Now there was even less light as night descended. He couldn't chance running into offshore obstacles or getting sideways to the surf. The roar of the waves 10 to 12 feet high hitting the walls of the shore blotted out all other noise. He was being thrown toward these walls. Rowing against the waves at his absolute limit, George struggled to keep the bow pointed out into the open ocean, trying to climb up the slope of the approaching waves, now over 15 feet high. To check where he was in relation to the almost vertical walls of the shore, he twisted around quickly for a glance, catching sight of an opening for a small stream in the wall, 20 or 25 feet ahead. Waves should be diminished here because the stream fed sand into the sea, decreasing depth and stealing the waves' energy as they dragged on the bottom. The opening instantly became his goal. Allowing his boat to get parallel to the waves would swamp him for sure. He fought to move ahead with the bow slightly to the south. His path was a zigzag, out a bit, back a bit, each time shifting him closer to the opening, but also carrying him each time closer to the rocky cliffs. Closer. Straining. Closer. The crack of oak wood sounded above the crashing waves. He kicked hard, slamming his heel against the boat seat to get his rubber boots off. If they filled with water, they would anchor him to the bottom. Standing in the boat with part of the transom broken off, George used one oar to pull with all that remained of his might toward the opening in the cliff. Another wave hit, again cracking the boat against the rocky cliff, throwing George out. George gripped the gunwale of the carcass of his boat and kicked hard, trying to urge the boat along the cliff. The next wave threw George and the boat against the cliff. As soon as the wave slacked off, George stroked at his limit, making as much progress as possible toward the break in the cliff. George was now ahead of the boat, no longer with the small bit of protection afforded by the boat when it was between him and the cliff. He stroked hard for the opening, knowing that the next wave would pick him up and slam him against the cliff. George opened his eyes. It was darker than a cellar. He was on his stomach with only his feet in water. He flexed his fingers. They dug into the coarse grit of sand. He didn't remember how he got here. The next wave must have thrown him into this opening instead of against the wall. He was so cold. He couldn't keep his teeth from chattering. He sat up and put his back against the wall. Exhausted, he fell asleep. Gray light invaded his tiny canyon, showing George his surroundings. He started upstream but was soon stopped as the canyon quickly narrowed. Halfway up the side of the canyon wall, he lost his strength. Edging himself back down, he knew he should build a fire, so he tried to find drier pieces of dead plant material. On the north side of his canyon, dead plant material in cracks and ledges had not been rained on directly and was only slightly damp. He collected what he could and spread it on the floor in the sunshine to dry. Recognizing flint in the cliff walls, George dragged the water-soaked bow of the boat up higher out of the water, looking for steel. The eye bolt on the bow presented itself. With a piece of wood from the boat stuck through the eye of the bolt, he screwed it out, then made sparks with the flint. As the day warmed, hunger gnawed at him. Dulse was the only thing he could find to chew on. Soon, thirst became his most prominent distraction. Using a 3-foot piece of the wreckage of his boat, George chose a spot about 30 feet back from the edge of the water at the highest tide and dug a hole in the sand down to solid rock, assuming that fresh water would collect in the hole. George put his big red handkerchief in the hole, willing it to soak up water. And it did darken as it got wet and collapsed with the weight. George watched a few more agonizing minutes before reaching into the hole and squeezing the wet cloth into his upturned mouth. His reward was a couple of teaspoons of water, which had a surprisingly fresh taste with just hints of handkerchief. Now he could be a bit more patient as the handkerchief got more thoroughly wet. He spent the next hour repeating the soaking, followed by the wringing of the cloth into his mouth. The tide was out, so George walked to the edge of the water, out past the walls of rock that made the coastline. Seeing nothing, no boats, George rested his back on the piece of boat he had dragged out of the water earlier. Taking in his surroundings, he calculated being only 8 or 9 miles from home. With little prospect of food or of attracting attention from a passing boat at this late morning hour, he resolved to try again to climb out. George took off his socks and climbed barefoot. The third path up the cliff brought him to the top, where he was welcomed by the covering of Irish moss. By keeping the sea on his left and walking steadily, he could see his farm by late afternoon. Though exhausted, his only thought was how worried his mother would be.
"Georgie! Georgie!"
his mother called as she ran from the garden out to meet him, tears running down her cheeks.
"We were so afraid the storm got you."
"I did have to throw out all the fish, and I had to make for shore after I pretty much ran out of starch. And then the boat broke up against a cliff, and—" As he chattered on as a release from tension and fear, He choked up and couldn't go on, tears streaming down his cheeks as he hugged his mother. Two brothers and three sisters joined them, all hugging and crying and repeating his name.
Sean, run into Cutler and let that group at Flannery's know that George had just walked in, and he's safe but lost his boat,
instructed Mrs. Bradley.
And you've got a bad bump on your forehead. We'll take care of that. Sorry to lose those fish in the boat. I just kept thinking about how we lost Father. That just made me row harder.
Although only 16 when his father died at sea in a vicious winter storm, George had become the primary provider for his widowed mother and five younger siblings. That was 2 years ago. He was everyone's favorite in the small community of Cutler. At daybreak, armed with his broad, attractive smile and a springy stride that made his curly locks bounce, he would hike the 2 miles from the Bradley farm, down the hill through the village to the docks 2, 3, sometimes 4 times a week, to take his skills out to prospect for another load of fish. There were usually several other townspeople about, and he exchanged greetings with all of them. He always seemed to have time for the village kids, his constant audience. Over 6 feet in height, he was as tall or taller than anyone in the small village. His broad face featured sparkling blue eyes, a slightly pugged nose, a distinct cleft chin, and a mouth that always seemed to be smiling. His curly, dark auburn Irish hair had almost completely hid his ears and stood above shoulders that had developed from merely broad at age 16 to thick and powerful as he grew older. 2 years later, his trim waist, a couple additional inches of height, and the confident way he carried himself suggested athleticism. An excellent student who enjoyed school, George had responded enthusiastically to the environment of the one-room schoolhouse. All that ended when George's father died. Perhaps when his two younger brothers were old enough to manage the farm and the fishing, he could think about more schooling. For now, he was the breadwinner. May 5. Although the day had begun under a particularly clear blue sky, it began to mist as George unloaded his catch in the early afternoon. After securing his dory to its place on the dock, he laid out his fresh catch on the drying racks, skin side up because of the mist. When the weather cleared, someone from the village would turn them over so they would dry faster. It was the neighborly thing to do. Then he sold those that were dry enough from previous catches. From these funds, he needed to give Thomas Flannery $1.25. The remaining dollar he would give to his mother. George was buying a dory from Thomas Flannery to replace the one wrecked in the storm. As he entered Flannery's general store to give Mr. Flannery his money, he expected the quiet of early afternoon to prevail. Instead, the static of gossip was making sparks. George listened to folks gathered around the unlit stove in the center of the room. As one, they turned to him and quietly stared. He asked, "What's going on?" Roger Belfast, the town cooper, spoke first.
"Jesus, Mary, Joseph, and St. Patrick. The war. The southern states declaring they be keeping slaves and are leaving the Union. Lincoln says, nay, you cannot."
Copies of the April 27th Boston newspapers had finally found their way to Cutler. The war that the Flannery group had predicted would be short and decisive was not going well for the North. The papers were filled with descriptions of the Confederates' success in battle after battle, with much talk about the North being able to free the slaves. George might have been upset if he had known that much of his dried cod went to feed slaves on plantations in the West Indies. The Boston Herald declared every able man should feel the responsibility to join the Union forces. Yes, he declared to himself. The pattern of his life suddenly changed. He must join one of these units being organized. He believed in Lincoln. He knew Lincoln was right. Then he realized that he couldn't leave the family without detailed preparations, which he would initiate as soon as he got home. His mind churned all the rest of the way. First, he'd have to convince his mother of the importance of his going. Then he'd have to spend a considerable amount of time with his two younger brothers, Sean and Adam. The two biggest problems would be getting his brothers to understand how to manage Millie and the chickens in winter conditions. He must also properly indoctrinate them about being careful to avoid dangerous weather. And they would have to help their mother run the farm in addition to catching enough fish to generate cash for the few things they would need to buy. He'd have to stay until his two brothers had absorbed these things. August 9. Feeling that his brothers were as prepared as they were going to be, George answered an ad in the Boston Herald for volunteers to form a unit of the 20th Regiment Marine Voluntary Infantry, which was to organize in August in Portland. His former teacher strongly recommended the unit because it was to be led by a faculty member from Bowdoin College, who he knew and had great respect for, Professor Joshua Chamberlain. August 19. George's orders to join the Maine 20th arrived. Cutler, as far north on the Maine coast as one can get without entering Canada, was about 165 miles northeast of Portland. George had never been out of Cutler, or farther than his farm, at least by land. Before light the next morning, his mother and his siblings fussed over him, packing food for his trip and offering lots of advice, all as indirect ways of telling him how much they loved him and how much they were going to miss him. He reciprocated by repeating many of the details they'd been over a number of times, the kind of details that accumulate in the long-term management of a farm. "Millie's left hind tit is pretty sensitive, so be sure to tuck her tail between your knee as you milk her, or she'll switch her tail right across your face. Don't let the hens hide their eggs from you, nor let them get too old before butchering. It's best to castrate the piglets between their first and second weeks." He reminded Sean and Adam about taking care of the dory and the best ways to catch cod. "Remember to use those landmarks to find the sweet spots between the main shore and about 3/4 of a mile from Grand Manan Island. You've just got to be really cautious about avoiding bad weather. I strongly suggest that you go no farther than an hour of rowing away from port. The family doesn't need more money than you can get by fishing about 3 times a week in the warm weather and can be skipped entirely in the coldest part of the year, especially if mother's careful about building up extra cash for the bad stretches of weather when it's far more dangerous to go out. And don't load the boat too full." George had provided a substantial body of knowledge, especially for two youngsters who weren't so sure they were ready for this responsibility. August 20. At daylight, the people of Cutler gathered on the dock to see George off on the mailboat.
"Oh, be so careful, Georgie," cautioned his mother through her quiet tears.
Sean and Adam and his sisters all tried to hug him at once. The regular crew from Flannery's general store also were consoling and offering advice. He said his goodbyes to people he had known all his life and stepped onto the mail schooner, making its regular stop at Cutler. August 21. In the light of early morning, before he would have to explain to anyone while he was sleeping in a stable, George brushed the straw from his clothes and walked into the main part of Belfast. From here, he bought a stagecoach ticket to Augusta. Arriving at dusk, George again found an unmanned livery stable. As he climbed into the mow, horses shifted in their stalls. He was just relaxing when he heard rustling in another part of the loft. In the little light that was left to the day, two figures approached out of the shadows. George rose to one knee as they drew nearer.
"Hello, Sonny. How come you sleeping rough?" came from one of the dark shapes. "You got any food to share? Hey, Albert, Looks to me like he might have something in that there bag. Is that right, boy?
One approached on George's left side, and the one that must be Albert approached on the right. Albert reached for George's sack, but George snatched it away and stood all the way up. The two drew back a few steps, perhaps in surprise at George's size. George stood there puzzled, holding his bag high up in his left hand. He had never encountered anyone who was threatening.
"What's the matter? We ain't good enough for you to share?"
Albert again reached for George's sack, but this triggered George's reflexes, and he quickly put the bag immediately behind him. Then he was startled to see the second man approaching and waving a pitchfork.
"Now, how about giving us that there sack?"
With George focused on the pitchfork, Albert grabbed George's sack and turned to flee. But George caught Albert's belt with his right hand and the stolen sack with the left. He lifted Albert off his feet and pitched him about 6 feet. The second man abandoned the pitchfork and tried hanging on to George's left arm. He threw a punch that just grazed George's head but did no damage. George got a better grip on the second man and threw him toward Albert. They were persistent, if not effective. Now it was Albert who grabbed the pitchfork.
"Now, give me that there sack,"
he said as he waved the weapon. The man feinted toward George and then stabbed the sack. Far quicker than the man had anticipated, George grabbed the neck of the fork and jerked it toward himself. The man couldn't let go of the handle quickly enough and came flying toward George, who grabbed the man's collar and threw him on past and into the barn wall. He hit with a solid crunching sound. George turned partway so he could see both men. The man who had hit the wall slowly got up, shook his head, made no attempt to pick up the pitchfork, and made a wide space around George as he moved unsteadily toward the loft opening. Then, without saying anything to his partner, he started down the ladder. The other man, with what could be read as an apologetic look, quickly followed his companion. George could make out their outlines as they disappeared down the ladder, leaving only a faint, stale scent of liquor. August 22. George's sleep after that episode was fitful and gave him second thoughts about sleeping in the lofts of liveries. In the morning, he suppressed his drowsiness to deal with the challenge of getting from Augusta to Brunswick. The fares posted at the stage depot in Augusta were, surprisingly, higher than those from Belfast to Augusta. "I'll just walk," he decided. With an early start and the map the pilot of the mail boat gave him, he estimated a long day's hike to Brunswick and another long day from Brunswick to Portland. He began looking for another stable or other suitable place to sleep as he continued toward the center of town. Passing two livery stables facing one another across the road, he noted several people milling around the one on his right, next to a bakery. He bought a loaf of bread for 3 pennies, then sauntered on, thinking to see Bowdoin College before backtracking to one of these as his resting place for the night. Just as he imagined, a few strides past Federal Street, the campus opened up to his left. Indeed, of the 5 buildings he could see, 3 were sturdy, rectangular, 4-story blocks, each with 8 chimneys, 4 on each side. Then, in astonishment, George looked up at the sharpest, tallest pair of church spires he'd ever seen. He walked on the broad green lawns around Old Main and 3 of the other buildings before starting back to choose his livery accommodations for another uneasy night. August 23. At first light, George awoke and was immediately thankful that he hadn't been bothered or even noticed. That was a good start on the 27-mile hike to Portland, eating bread and cheese as he walked briskly along the far side of the campus and into the gray opening of the day. George hiked at a good pace for at least an hour. Morning traffic still hadn't reached its peak when he came upon a rig parked by the side of the road, just outside of Freeport. A middle-aged man wearing a stovepipe hat and rather formal clothes, obviously anxious about something, was attending to a small child. George offered, with the innocence that comes from living in an isolated community of fewer than 150 residents,
"May I help, sir?"
"Oh, young man, oh, yes, you certainly may. I need to take my child to Portland to see a special doctor, and she's restless, which makes it hard to drive. If you wouldn't mind helping with the child for however far you're going, I would be much indebted. She is so listless, and we've tried everything. My wife planned to come with us, but her sister began laboring to deliver her first baby shortly after midnight, so my wife is staying with her sister. We couldn't delay seeing the doctor in Portland any longer, so—" George immediately turned to the child, smiling broadly, took her hand, and spoke to her.
"Are you going on a trip with your daddy?"
And in reply to her small, shy nod, he added,
"Would you mind if I come along?"
And as if in response to the answer of his question, George climbed into the carriage. The child, probably 4 years old, was quite shy at first, but did seem to find George acceptable and allowed him to place her on his lap.
"This will be a great help. How far are you going?" the father asked.
George explained that he was going to Portland to join the 20th Regiment Marine Voluntary Infantry.
"Well, what a coincidence. A friend of mine will be leading your regiment, Professor Chamberlain. We served together on the faculty at Bowdoin College. By the way, my name's Arthur Husey. And yours?"
"I'm George Bradley, sir."
He offered his hand by reaching around the child on his lap.
"So you must be a professor? I've never met a real professor, but my school teacher graduated from Bowdoin College. At one time, he thought I should go there, but then my father died."
The rhythmic rocking of the buggy lulled the child to sleep on George's lap.
"Ah, I see she's fallen asleep. That's good. She'll travel easier that way. Tell me, what subjects did you find most interesting in school?"
"I liked them all, sir. If I had to pick a favorite, I guess it would be when we went into the meadows and woods and learned the flowers and the trees, or to the shore and learned the creatures in the tide pools."
"Then you might like my discipline, geology."
"I'm afraid I don't know what that is, sir."
"It's the study of rocks and fossils in the rocks, though some rocks don't have fossils. The rocks and their fossils help us understand the history of Earth."
George was fascinated. He had never thought of Earth having a history. Professor Hussey kept feeding that fascination as he described how he took his students into the field to look for fossils. "They tell us about the time when they were alive and why this indicated that Earth was far older, far, far older than George could imagine." As the buggy whizzed along, time disappeared beneath its skinny wheels. It seemed only minutes, and Professor Hussey was suggesting that they stop for a bite to eat as they entered the north side of the village of Yarmouth. He pulled up at the hitching rail in front of the West Custigo Inn just on the north side of the Royal River.
"I have food in my bag, sir. If you don't mind, I can wait in the buggy," George replied, still holding the child.
"Nonsense. You're providing me a useful service. Well, the least I can do is purchase dinner for you."
The professor tied the horse to the hitching rail. Having given the horse a feed sack of oats, he said,
"Here, let me take Hattie."
Their conversation continued through the meal, questions quickly forming in George's mind, his view of the world growing and changing by the minute. Professor Hussey told about how he was inspired to study geology when he heard Charles Lyell, a British geologist, speak when he was touring the United States. Almost without interrupting the flow of their talking, the professor handed Hattie, still sleepy but awake, to George, paid the bill, returned to the rig, removed the horse's feed bag, placed it under the seat of the carriage, and they were on their way. With the ocean on their left and rock outcrops and timber on their right, The professor frequently would point to different parts of the landscape to make a point about some geological feature or process. As they neared Portland, the professor asked,
"Do you need directions to where you're to report for duty?"
"Yes, sir. I'm supposed to report to Camp Mason," George replied. Pulling a watch from his waistcoat, the professor said,
"I'm afraid I can't take you all the way to the camp, but I can give you directions. Oh, and there's another thing I can offer in payment for the badly needed services you've provided. I'll take a minute to write a quick note to Professor Chamberlain to give him my very high recommendations of you."
"Well, that's okay, sir. You've not only given me a ride, saving me a day's travel, but more important, you've shown me a lot about things I've never thought about, and I'll never forget. I'll never look at the country the same way again."
"I would be pleased to see you at Bowdoin after you complete your army duties. You're a fine and intelligent young man," said the professor, as he handed George the note sealed with red sealing wax and shook George's hand.